Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. The thing I want to talk about today is the life of Friedrich Engels, Karl Marx's great collaborator and the writer with Marx of the Communist Manifesto, and his own work based around his experiences in Manchester at the height of the Industrial Revolution. And his own influence. His own influence on British social and radical reformers of the 19th century and the labour movement of the 20th century is considerable. And you can see echoes of his writing throughout much of what has been written on the Industrial Revolution throughout the period. The first critiques of industrialism and industrialisation and the talk of the condition of the working class stem from Engels' observations. There is a school of thought, a entirely separate historiography, that argues that despite the suffering of the English working class during the Industrial Revolution, overall living standards by the end of the 19th century had significantly improved, taking issue with the idea that it was all bad. I think it's always interesting with these arguments to look at what's really being said here, that on average, perhaps living standards had improved, but the question always is at what cost, and who, in the view of Engels, had been supplying the labour and supplying the surplus value, the surplus labour value or profits for capital. Okay, so without further ado, let's talk some more. Let's talk about who Engels actually was. Well, both Marx and Engels come from reasonably privileged backgrounds. Marx's father was a vintner. He owned vineyards. He was a German Jew who had converted to Protestantism in order to be more assimilated. The Jewish part of Marx's life is fairly minor affair. It's not something that is a significant issue when thinking about Marx, really. He had moved away from all forms of kind of religious observance as a young man, and the same is true of Engels. Engels' family were in the cotton business. They were well-to-do cotton manufacturers, extremely wealthy cotton manufacturers in point of fact, and very pious Protestants. The decision by Engels not to pursue his faith and to declare himself an atheist, greatly upset his mother. Engels was typical of a generation of young German men who lived within what at that point was the German Confederation. The set of states that had been established by the Congress of Vienna. It had replaced the Confederation of the Rhine, which was created by Napoleon, and that in turn had replaced the Holy Roman Empire. So if you were a young man growing up in the midst of this political change, in this successor state that had replaced the state that had replaced the state that had lasted for 1,000 years, you might possibly be susceptible to new political ways of thinking. The structure of the world beneath your feet has been profoundly shaken. Engels found a philosopher that suited him, and it suited Marx as well. And the person who they connected with was Hegel, G.W.F. Hegel. There's probably not the room in this podcast, nor perhaps the expertise for me, to go too deeply into everything Hegel talked about. But one of the basic fundamental principles of Hegelianism that translates itself into Marx is this idea, this is almost his eschatological idea, of history being a journey or a set of processes, and that essentially that history moves through phases. Marx fully agreed with this. Hegel said that you have your sort of your plateaus and then your kind of upward ascents. So there is the Middle Ages, for example, is a plateau where, you know, not much is changing for a long period of time and reach a certain level of civilization, and then we have to go up the slope again with new innovation, new political ideas, new concepts and thoughts. I think Hegel believed that that slope, that ascent to the summit, was extremely bloody, but once you get there, it really is worth it. And this is an idea that underscores many of the kind of the revolutionary thinkers of the 20th century, that the payoff in the end will be so good that it really will justify all the hardship along the way. And it is the likes of Lenin and Mao, and Stalin obviously, who decide who will pay the price for utopia. And what suffering is necessary in order to reach the promised land. Reading between the lines, Engels seems to have been the family nuisance. He was raised in the kind of the growing industrial town of Barmen in Prussia, and he's sent away to Bremen to work in the family business first, and then he's sent to the army to become an artillery officer. His mother writes pained letters to him, pleading with him to abandon these new atheist ideas that he's developing and to come home and essentially be a good boy. And he is part of this kind of generation that participates in, well, he doesn't personally participate in, but he's part of the generation that does participate in the 1848 revolutions. And there, he's part of, I guess you could call it kind of a pan-European generation of educated and philosophically engaged young men. Mainly, it is men at this period in time. There are women who are in that position, but by and large, in the kind of the patriarchal world of the early 19th century, politically engaged young women found far fewer outlets to become politically active. He first met Karl Marx in 1842, and they apparently didn't get on particularly well, and they met again 2 years later in Paris at this point, where neither of them are welcome in Germany for their subversive views. The founding ideas, the founding kind of tenets of Marxism are not made by this point, by the way. It really has to be a sojourn in Britain that brings that about. Engels was sent to Manchester to work in the family business there. The cotton industry, the world capital of that was Manchester by the 1840s, and this reflected Britain's control over the global cotton industry. He was situated at the Victoria Mill in Manchester, which was dedicated towards the manufacture of sewing thread. And he met and fell in love with a working-class Manchester woman, Mary Burns, who he had a relationship with for the next two decades, till 1863, when she died. And she initially is his kind of native guide. She shows him around the roughest and the hardest hit districts of Manchester. She was from Salford, and she, her father had been a dyer, the cotton mills, and so she knew exactly what life was like for the poorest of the poor in Manchester, and the two of them were always opposed to marriage. Marriage was a bourgeois institution. It was how modern capitalist society created nuclear families in which to create workers, and it was a tool of class oppression in their view. The view is it's difficult sometimes to sit to know precisely what Engels' thoughts were, as he didn't write a great deal about her. And obviously much of what we have to go on with Engels comes from his voluminous written works. But what it does show is how engaged Engels was with this foreign country that he had arrived in, and how sort of fascinated and appalled he was by the condition of England's working class. Now, it's not to say that there weren't poor people in Prussia. Of course, there were. There was industrialisation in Prussia as well. But industrialisation had been going on for a lot longer in Britain. And industrialisation had gone to far greater heights in Britain than it had anywhere else in the world. The urban conurbation of Manchester was perhaps one of the biggest cities in the world at that point, and it had sprung up from a relatively few small villages and towns. So the thing that Engels was seeing, really, was the process of the development of capitalism right before his very eyes. This fitted in with some of the things that Hegel had already been saying about transitioning from one phase of history to another, and you know, the evidence seemed to be all around both Engels and later Marx, when Marx comes to Great Britain too. What Engels can see here is he refers to Manchester as a shock city. And says that what he can see is polarisation. What he's talking about is the development of class. He says that there are mill owners and workers, and they are polarised into two groups that are irreconcilable, antagonistic, and that they're the...
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Things that the mill owners want, i.e. surplus labour value or profit, and the things that the workers want, fair pay and decent living conditions, are incompatible with one another. And this becomes the foundation for much of Marx and Engels' work later on, that the idea of this journey through history that Hegel is talking about is punctuated by anything at all. It's punctuated by endless class struggle. The class struggle is, you know, sometimes hidden, sometimes exposed, but always ongoing. But it was more than just Hegel pouring into Engels' work and then Engels and Marx's work. They benefited from the English economists and Scottish economists of the 18th century, people like Adam Smith. They were very keen on understanding how it is capitalism seemed to work. Capitalism, by the way, was never a phrase thought up by capitalists. This is a term of Marxist analysis. People who originally formulated what the new commercial and industrial world that was developing in the 18th century, they formulated what it actually was. They didn't refer to it specifically in a title as anything at all. It was referred to, there was talk of trade and markets and mercantile activity, but it never gets an actual name. Free market capitalism is as a critique of the left, and it's interesting that the its proponents these days, all politicians on the right of the political spectrum, talk about this. They constantly harp on about capitalism. They don't realise the term is as always used, always coined by its opponents. There you go. They examined the works of Adam Smith, and they gained a great deal. Both Marx and Engels gained a great deal from reading this. And the two men were in no doubt that, say what you like about capitalism, it has immense transformative powers. You know, it can it has brought about the greatest revolution in human affairs that so far had ever been seen. They examined the works of people like Pierre-Joseph Proudhon and Fourier, in Paris, who were perhaps the leading revolutionary thinkers of the day in Europe prior to Marx and Engels. But their version, their take on revolutionary thought was really far more anarchist and against the notion of organised or centralised power at all. Proudhon famously said that he believed all property was theft, that originally if you have any material resources at all, i.e. land, well, land had never belonged to anybody in the first place, or perhaps back as far back as you can go in human history, it had belonged to everybody and nobody. And land ownership involved some kind of theft at some point along the way, some sort of enclosure act. So he said that, you know, no property was particularly legitimate in any way. But out of that culture of revolutionary writing and thinking throughout 19th century Europe is the Communist Manifesto that really has the greatest impact. If we go back for a moment and look at Engels' work on the condition of the English working class that he published in 1845, he starts the book by saying the following things. He says, "The condition of the working class is the real basis and point of departure for all social movements of the present, because it is the highest and most unconcealed pinnacle of the social misery existing in our day." And he adds to that, "21 months I had the opportunity to become acquainted with the English proletariat, its strivings, its sorrows, its joys, to see them from near, from personal observation and personal intercourse, and at the same time to supplement my observations by recourse to the requisite authentic sources. What I have seen, heard, and read has been worked up in the present book. I am prepared to see not only my standpoint attacked in many quarters, but also the facts I have cited, particularly when the book gets into the hands of the English. I know equally well that here and there I may be proved wrong in some particular of no importance, something that in the view of the comprehensive nature of the subject and its far-reaching assumptions, even an Englishman might be unable to avoid. So much the more, so since even in England there exists as yet not a single piece of writing which, like mine, takes up all the workers. But without a moment's hesitation, I challenge the English bourgeoisie to prove that even in a single instance of any consequence for the exposition of my point of view as a whole, I have been guilty of any inaccuracy, and to provide it by data as authentic as mine." Now, that sounds very combative when he wrote that preface. And he was expecting criticism, and he was expecting his work to be dismissed and ignored. And part of the reason for this is that both Marx and Engels held the English middle class, the English bourgeoisie, as they saw them, in particular low regard. I think that they looked upon Britain as a kind of a valueless, cultureless vacuum where money had entirely corrupted the character of the middling sorts, and had resulted in this orgiastic free-for-all. And he believed that it was the middle classes of England that were in the greatest denial about the state of the country that they dominated. One of the themes of the book is the theme of alienation, that something not just material poverty had happened to the working classes in Britain, but a spiritual poverty as well. That they had been divorced from the artisan economy that they had existed in. Put simply, most things were made by hand up until the Industrial Revolution by people at home, people who wove, dyed, tanned, leatherworked, who baked, or who carved, or, you know, all these many things. And at the end of the process of making a thing, there was a sense of deep human satisfaction that a product had been produced, and that some of one's labours kind of meant something, that there was a relationship between one and the object. The factory reversed that. Not only does the individual within the factory not become a creator of anything, you actually become a factor of production because you're going into a factory. The tasks in front of the worker are broken down into small and repetitive tasks, and the job is partly automated. It's long, it's repetitive, it's unstimulating, and the mass-produced product at the end of it, one has very little sense of connection with, one has very little sense of creativity. And Engels believed that human creativity was an essential part of the process of being. This is not really a controversial idea. It's been something that most psychologists, sociologists, and social observers have really embraced in the past 150 years or so. And his view of artisan life in Britain prior to the Industrial Revolution is perhaps a little romanticised, let me tell you. So he says, before the introduction of machinery, the spinning and weaving of raw materials was carried out in the working man's home. Wife and daughter spun the yarn that the father wove or that they sold, if he did not work it up himself. These weaver families lived in the country, in the neighbourhood of the towns, and could get on fairly well with their wages because the home market was almost the only one, and the crushing power of competition that came later with the conquest of foreign markets and the extension of trade did not yet press upon wages. There, obviously, he's talking about the development of the British Empire. There was, further, a constant increase in the demand for the home market, keeping pace with the slow increase in population and employing all workers. There was also an impossibility of vigorous competition of the workers among themselves, consequent upon the rural dispersion of their homes. So it was that the weaver was usually in a position to lay by something and rent a little piece of land that he cultivated in his leisure hours, of which he had as many as he chose to take. I think that's probably quite implausible, since he could weave whenever and as longer as he pleased. True, he was a bad farmer and managed his land ineffectively, often obtaining but poor crops. Nevertheless, he was no proletarian and had a stake in the country, which in which he was permanently settled, and stood one step higher in a society than the English workman of today. So the idea is that the conditions of the English working class had declined as a result of the Industrial Revolution. That world that Engels is describing, I think, is perhaps too romanticised to ever really have exist. It sounds like some kind of wonderful, relaxed, and generally very rosy existence. It's perhaps the world that you would create if you had witnessed the Industrial Revolution firsthand. But yeah, I think that needs to be taken with a pinch of salt. And for Engels, the process of industrialisation had dehumanised the working class. It had alienated them from their very core selves and their material activity in the world. So it was this writing and that influences most of Marx and Engels' thought for the next 30 or so years, and it also influences the generations of British social radicals who emerged, people like the Social Democratic Federation under Henry Hindman, the Fabians, if you go all the way through to the Communist Party of Great Britain's historians, the likes of E.P. Thompson, who wrote The Making of the English Working Class, the foundation stone of that book was The Condition of the English Working Class in 1845 by Friedrich Engels. Okay, so I've gone on long enough. I'll leave you now, and I hope you find that useful, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.